A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Guitar Nerds Live, the live podcast that's about guitars and stuff. I'm your host for the evening, Mark Packham, joined by Jay Cross.
Hi, Mark.
Hello
and
there.
And people in chat.
For those of you that have not heard one of the live podcasts before, we're recording this live on our Discord server. And you can join that if you want to, if you're listening to this after it's been recorded. You can join the Discord server by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/guitar nerds. And anywhere from the $1 tier and up, you get access to the private Discord server. And you can listen to us record this live. You can join in. You'll hear through the show. Hopefully we get some people on the line to share their thoughts. If not, we're just taking text from the live chat, and we should have a jolly good time all around. So what are we talking about tonight on this Guitar Nerds Live? We are talking about a topic, Jay, that you raised a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, so an article that I saw on Music Radar maybe 2 weeks ago or so about Francis Rossi from, of course, as if Francis Rossi needs any introduction, but Francis Rossi of Status Quo is selling his Telecaster. Now, yeah. The Francis Rossi Tele is something that we've spoken about on the podcast many times. But for people who don't know, it's an absolutely quality late 50s Ron Seal green Tele with a couple of extra holes dug all the way through it. And he is very famous. Status Quo very famous for playing Telecasters. This is something that might not translate to listeners outside of the United Kingdom, because when Maddie, my girlfriend, moved to the UK from the US about 5 years ago, she had never heard of Status Quo, and that completely blew my mind, because they're just like a British institution when it comes to rock and roll music.
It's like woven into the fabric of British life. Is like, yeah, if you don't know about the live performance of rocking all over the world from Live Aid, then, you know, are you really British?
Oh, exactly. And in fact, her first introduction to Status Quo was going to the football and hearing people singing football chants to the tune of Status Quo songs, right, and not realizing that it was, you know, actual music. So anyway, as I say, Status Quo, really well known for their Telecasters, and Francis Rossi has played this green Tele seemingly forever. And the article gives a bit of a history on it. Basically, he bought it. So it's a 1957 Tele that he bought in 1968. So it was already, you know, 10 years old or so. And, you know, presumably you buy a guitar that's 10 years old, you're like, yeah, I mean, whatever, it's just a piece of junk, isn't it? It doesn't really matter what I do with it. And obviously 50 years later, with a load of hindsight, that guitar would have been, if it had been kept in pristine nick, that guitar would be worth, you know, unbelievable sums of money. I mean, it still is, because Francis Rossi played it for a really long time. But what this kind of spurred me into thinking of is, having this guitar been played for 50 years and Status Quo being an extremely prolific live touring band, are there any other guitars that have been played as many times live as Francis Rossi's Tele? So, as I said, I've run the numbers. And with the help of a little bit of sort of guesswork, and also this really cool website, setlist.fm, which is a website where you can submit set lists from gigs that you've been to, and it will tell you how many times your favorite bands have played songs that you know, their songs, which I think actually is very cool. I'm all about sort of cataloging things in that style. So using a bit of back and forth with and a bit of guesswork, Francis Rossi bought this guitar in 1968 and he retired it in 2015. Now, assuming that he played every single show with it in between 1968 and 2015, that means this guitar has done 3,500 gigs.
That's a lot.
I feel like that's quite a lot. And as I say, I was trying to work out if there's anything that comes close to or, you know, has done more than that. Because 3,500 gigs, I don't think I've done anything 3,500 times. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's like, a lot of gigs.
Keep it clean, whatever you're about to say, keep it clean.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. There's a fair few things that, you know, that have probably done 3,500 times. Yeah, I mean, that is a lot of gigs. So you've also gone through and done some maths on other people's stuff. I mean, bear in mind, we are assuming in this that he's played that guitar for every gig.
Which, from what I gather, he did. I mean, yeah, sure, maybe there was a few here and there. But, you know, even at 3,500, I think we can expect a, you know, even if there's a margin of error of 10%, he's probably still higher than most other people would ever come close to.
I'm just doing a quick Google search, like a Google image search that to just see, like, are there any photos of him live with any other guitar? And I'm scrolling down now. I've probably looked at, I don't know, maybe 200 images so far, and I can't find a picture of him playing another guitar live. There's one where he's got like, he's like sat on a sofa, he's obviously doing like a session or something, and he's got like a butterscotch telly. But every live picture that I can find, he's got the green telly.
Yeah, I mean, it is possible that that, you know, he played one of the replicas, because there was, again, as we've talked about on the podcast before, there was a run of Fender Japan, were they?
Yeah, they were, yeah.
Japan, but there wasn't many, was there? So, you know, it's I think it's fair to assume that he probably had a couple of those. So maybe he used one of those for a while, but yeah, I think it's likely that he used that more than anything else. So anyway, we kind of put out into the chat, you know, is there anything else? And we did a bit of research, and I actually found a article, and I reckon this article is probably also influenced by this Music Radar article. So there's an article on Ultimate Guitar, which said, which is from 5 days ago, which is six legendary guitars still in use. And so these are guitars that are like iconic guitars owned by iconic guitar players that they've used for a really long time. And some of the ones that are on here are Brian May's Red Special, Jimmy Page and his Gibson Les Paul number one, Bonnie Raitt and her Brownie Strat.
Bonnie Raitt, sorry.
What did I say?
Yeah. Bonnie Raitt, which is punk covers band.
Sorry, Bonnie Raitt. And Keith Richards and his telly, of course. And a guitar that is extremely close to the hearts of guitar nerds, as we talk about this all the time, Bruce Springsteen's telly, or Esquire, depending on how pedantic you're going to be. And another one, which is something that I hadn't really thought about, but that's kind of why I wanted to talk about this on the podcast, is once you get away from kind of punk and rock, I guess, as a whole, I sort of struggle, and I didn't know whether there were any country artists or any metalers out there who, you know, I don't know if Tony Iommi had been playing the same SG for, you know, 40 years or whatever. But with regards to country artists, Willie Nelson came up on this list as well. And apparently he has played his Martin N20 since 1969. So yeah. There's a few there, and you know, I've got some of the numbers on these. I wonder if there's if you had anything else that you thought maybe would be up there.
Well, the ones that spring to mind, so I'm just looking at Tony Iommi. So looking at photos of him, it does appear that he often uses the same guitar. There are pictures of him from what looks like the 80s where he is playing something else. But, I mean, he is often seen using that kind of the brown guitar, which has got, you know, like the crosses on the fretboard and stuff like that. So that might be worth running the numbers on. There's also a couple pictures of him with a Strat as well.
Really?
But it does what? Mainly
three single coils.
Yeah. So the story, well, I'm not sure if that's I'm trying to find that picture again. I'll just scroll past it. But so the story of that is when they were recording the first Black Sabbath album, and I think I'm getting this story correct. When they were recording the first Black Sabbath album, he had a Strat with him. And obviously being left-handed, you know, there wasn't like an abundance of guitars around. So he had this Strat and they went to record the first album and it in some way it broke. I can't remember what it was. And the only other guitar they could find was the SG. And yeah, so he reluctantly started using the SG on this album. And then that obviously subsequently became kind of like the birth of heavy metal. It would before that, it would have, if that Strat hadn't broken, that would have been the sound of Black Sabbath.
That is very strange. I wonder if they would have turned into, you know, if those songs would have been like Dire Straits or something rather than the birth of heavy metal.
There is actually a photo of him here. So yeah, he has played other guitars because, like I said, if you're looking at all of their gigs, by the looks of it, the first gigs would have been he was playing a Strat. And then in the 80s, there were like, I can't tell the brand, but there's something that's got like a weird, like reverse Firebird headstock on it. There's a lot of these things where I think what you'll see is that if they've been playing since like the 60s, they played one guitar for ages, and in the 80s, when like endorsements became a big thing, they like go off and play something else. And in fact, one that you didn't mention in your opening spiel that we've talked about in the past is Chaz and Dave and the bass used by Dave. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
So there's a really great documentary called Last Orders. So, I mean, you know, Mark and I are unapologetic in our love for Chaz and Dave. And again, this is kind of something that might not have translated to listeners outside of the UK. But Chaz and Dave were session musicians in the 60s. Played in a bunch of bands. Like Chaz very famously played bass for Jerry Lee Lewis on a couple of his tours of the UK in the early days, and Gene Vincent as well, I think.
Yep.
I want to
Gene
say
Vincent. Yeah.
And Dave originally back in the day was in the Rolling Stones, not that Rolling Stones, a different band called the Rolling Stones, who on one of their early tours were supported by the Beatles. They went on to be in, Chaz was in this band, Heads, Hands and Feet with, Albert Lee and, who else was in that? Was Clapton in that? Clapton wasn't in that, was he?
Maybe. I know that obviously they were kind of like, there was a kind of collective of musicians and Clapton was one of them, but I don't know on that particular band.
There's a really great documentary called Last Orders, which is all about Chaz and Dave's first last tour, which was, I think, in 2012, 2013, something like that. Dave's wife died, which really hit him for six, and he basically said, like, look, I can't do this anymore, I can't go out on tour, I just need to, like, you know, knock it on the head. And so this documentary is all about them kind of on their last tour and their last London show, and it's just got a load of archive footage. And there is a clip where with Dave Peacock with his I think it's a 1969 P bass, which allegedly he bought new in 1969, and he reckons that back then, so, you know, 5-10 years ago, whatever, he reckons that that bass has done more gigs than any other instrument in the UK. And I mean, everyone's got a story about seeing Chaz and Dave down like the Dog and Duck in, you know, 1994 or something like that. So it really would not surprise me if that bass has played more. But I couldn't find any statistics on how many shows they've played, probably because you'd need a separate internet to list all of the shows that they've played.
It's too many. It will break the internet.
Yeah, I don't think there's enough space on the internet. And also, I'm not sure that Chaz and Dave have quite got the following of some of the bands who have got the dedicated fan base that would list their set lists on setlist.fm, because they've only got 124 shows dating from 1976 up to 2018, which I can tell you is definitely incorrect.
The other thing about Chaz and Dave, and Dave Peacock specifically, is firstly, it's a broken run as well, because I know for a long time in the, I think, late 70s and early 80s, he was using Yamaha BB basses. So
BB basses.
And that would have kind of broken the run of the P bass. But also, one thing to consider with Chaz and Dave is they used to do, from what I understand, they used to do a fair few gigs where he actually didn't even play bass. They would do like, you know, like cafe gigs and stuff like that, where both of them would play guitar. Because it's worth mentioning.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
Both of them can kind of do everything. You know, I think both of them play the drums. Both of them, obviously, you know, Dave plays bass. Chaz played piano. Yeah. But like, they also they also do, like, you know, they can all both play like mandolin and like guitar. So if you go through, if you do like a Google image search for them, actually a lot of the pictures, he's not even playing bass. He's playing like a little Spanish acoustic.
Okay, yeah. I think he's done a lot on ukulele and stuff as well. But yeah, I mean, it just unbelievable musicians, and they sort of don't really get the credit they deserve because, you know, the songs are maybe a little bit risque in sort of in 2020 or 2019 terms. Nowadays.
Some of it hasn't aged well.
But the ones that have are just absolutely amazing. And because their lyrics are all a bit funny and they were kind of a caricature of themselves, they don't really get the credit for being the, like, incredible musicians that they are. You know, I mean, there's a really good clip that you should try and track down. I'll try and put it in the group at some point, of a band that was really short-lived. I think they did a 7-inch and nothing else. And it's Chaz Hodges on piano. It's Phil Lynott from Thin Lizzy on bass. And the geezer from Wizard, whose name
I... Roy Wood.
Roy Wood from Wizard playing guitar, plus a drummer who I can't remember who it was, but again, they were in like a big band. And there's just this incredible video of them just like playing a gig down, like, yeah, the Dog and Duck or the Queen's Head or something together. And it's just amazing. Like, they're just unbelievable musicians. And,
John Coughlin is the drummer.
Okay. What was he in?
I was just trying to find that. The problem is going through this, like, I'm looking at Chaz's discography right now, and there's just too much. Right? Let me just see if I can quickly Google.
So another thing that they say in, actually, I don't think this is in the documentary. I think it's in on his Twitter. So Chaz died a couple of years ago, maybe a year or so ago. Actually, it's coming up to about a year ago, and really sad. But he was fantastic, and he had a great Twitter account, and he put up not long before he died, he put up a picture of his Hofner president. Is that what that basically?
Yeah, I think it was a president.
Hofner president, which he bought in like 1950 something, and or like the early 60s, and he reckons that that was the first electric bass in the UK, because he said that basically he bought that bass and everyone wanted him to be in their band because everyone else had double basses and double basses were not cool. So, you know, the fact that he had that before anyone else is just incredible.
So bringing it all back around to where we started, John Coughlin from the Rockers with Chaz and Chaz, Roy Wood, and Phil Lynott was the original drummer for Status Quo.
Okay.
There we go. So another guitar that I was thinking of, and various iterations of it maybe, and I don't know how we're going to qualify this, but Billy Joe Armstrong's Blue Fernandez Strat, I reckon, has done a lot of gigs. Now, how you would kind of qualify that? Because obviously, you know, I'm not sure if he's even using the real one anymore. I'm pretty sure he's using a replica. But, you know, are we doing it by like how many songs it's been used on or literally how many gigs? Because, you know, if we're talking about Green Day, obviously that's like one guitar that he uses in a set. It's not like Dave's P-Bass.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the question was about gigs, so, you know, I think even if it only comes out to play Basket Case, then I think that's probably all right,
still counts. Did we get a gig total for Willie Nelson?
Yeah, I did. So I did actually get that. So just going back to, I mean, this is sort of all over the place, but basically Willie Nelson, he bought the guitar in 69, and the story here is that he had a Baldwin, which is a brand I don't really know anything about. I don't know if I should, but yeah, apparently he had a Baldwin guitar, and the Martin N20, which is a nylon strung guitar, he bought in, which he calls Trigger, he bought in 1969, and apparently still plays it. And on his setlist.fm page, that lists him at 2,900 shows since 1969. So a little way off the Francis Rossi, but I mean, that is still some going. Really, really some going. And, you know, I don't know if there's, I mean, maybe that's up there with acoustic guitars, because I would really struggle to think of anyone else, any other acoustic guitar players who've played, you know, for 50 years with.
I bet you there are multiple classical guitar players who have used the same instrument for that amount of time.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
Probably done more gigs, I'd imagine, but they're probably not anywhere near as well known. That's the problem with trying to track these things down. So just a bit of an overview on Baldwin. So just because I like to fill in facts, Baldwin Piano Company is still an American piano brand. They used to, I believe, make like it's a complicated history, because at one time they were owned by Gibson. They began in 1857 when Dwight Hamilton Baldwin began teaching piano, organ and violin. So I think probably that would have been like maybe like a catalog guitar. And down the line, again, the kind of history of Baldwin goes all over the place. But they bought Burns at one point. And then they went bankrupt in 2001 and were bought by Gibson. I believe they are now they are still a subsidiary of Gibson Guitar Corporation.
Gibson Brands, I think it is now still. That puts them right up there. So what did you say, 1857 did you say they started?
Yeah.
So that means that they are not quite as old as Martin, obviously starting in the 1830s, but still, I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So just carrying this on with regards to other guitars that have done loads of gigs, Bruce Springsteen, he's often talked about Telecaster or Esquire, which is a Tele with an Esquire neck, and it's had loads of work done over the years. But, you know, I mean, it's a 50-year-old guitar, and you know that it is what it is. It's been out and worked every night, so I can only imagine that it has had a load of work done to it. But again, this is he bought it in 1973, and just looking at that setlist.fm page, some of his most prolific touring was around that time, 73, 74, 75. And he retired the guitar in 2005 because he reckoned that it was just like deteriorating beyond repair. So he retired it there, but they reckon that he played 1,800 shows with that.
Okay.
And I would say that if you've ever been to a Bruce Springsteen show, they are completely bonkers, and they go on for eight. So I've seen him, and he played for 3 hours. It was at the Emirates, which is the Arsenal stadium, and I really felt like I was behind enemy lines, because it was just, you know, I went to the bathroom at one point, and there was just all these Arsenal pictures on the wall. But, you know, I behaved myself. It's fine.
Good. No graffitiing, or you didn't take a marker pen in with you or anything like that.
No.
So that could have potentially done the most minutes on stage, maybe.
Actually,
again.
That's exactly what I was getting to. So Joe has just rocked up to the rocked up in the chat, and he's
about
talking
time.
About that. Yeah, about time. You know, that's fine. We said we were starting at 8, but you know, it's fine. He obviously had something more important to be doing. But he points out that the Springsteen's guitars, the frets in Springsteen's guitars are triangular. I don't really know what he means by that. Triangular pointing upwards or pointing downwards? Because they're all triangular pointing downwards, sort of.
Joe, apparently he's going to come on and explain. No, you're banned from this. You're not allowed.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, no. Sorry, mate. Sorry, you were late, I'm afraid, Joe.
Yeah, yeah. So,
go on, are you going to bring him in?
Yeah, I'll bring him in. Hang on. Right. Oh, he can already be in. He's just muted himself. So he needs to unmute himself and then he can come on. So before Oh, God, there he is.
Oh, no. Yes.
How's your weekend been, Joe?
It's been about 18 hours since we saw each other.
It has. Yes. No, yes. It's been absolutely fantastic. Wonderful.
Tell us about the Springsteen guitar and then do one.
Springsteen guitar, his guitar is really interesting because it was already super old by the time Bruce Springsteen even got hold of it. Because he bought it from, I can't remember the name of the shop. I need to look it up whilst we're talking. But he bought it from a shop secondhand. Well, the shop had taken it on from a nearby studio where it had been being used as the kind of the studio guitar. And it had several outputs, and it was rooted for all these different types of pickups. So it had already been massively customized when Bruce Springsteen bought it, and he bought it for, you know, not a lot of money on account of that.
$185.
Yeah. Which is ridiculous. But the thing about the frets, they've got a really specific name, which is the name of the guy who owned the shop. He developed his own type of frets that were supposed to be like a micro accurate. So they were pointed. So they were, as in they were triangular, as in rather than being sort of rounded, they went to a fine point on the end, which is supposed to make them super accurate. You know, I appreciate no one else has ever taken on that sort of style of making frets. So that might not be the case at all. But Bruce Springsteen has all of his guitars redone with that fret styling by the fella who he sold the guitar, he bought the guitar from. But really interesting guitar, because it was already so wrecked by the time he got it.
I've just done the reading whilst you've been talking there, Joe, and it really does my head in when you're right.
It really
does my head in when you're right. So the person you're talking about is Phil
Patillo. That's it. Yeah.
Patillo, I guess. Patillo, I'm not sure. So he bought it from him in don't know where it was, but that's fine. But yes, it was his patented precision frets, which we're trying.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, really, really weird, interesting thing. But yeah, Springsteen's really taken that on and has had that fitted in all of his guitars and his Fender Custom Shops that he's had made since then, modeled after his Esquire.
Okay.
But yeah, really interesting. It's an Esquire.
Telecaster.
It's
quite neck, so you know.
In terms of the routing, Joe, you mentioned that it's routed in a kind of weird way. Do you know what are the actual details on that?
So I don't know the specifics. I know that the guitar had to have an awful lot of work when it was taken into the shop in the first place, just because, as I said, it was designed as a studio guitar. And I think the idea that the studio had come up with is they had a couple of, it was maybe three or four outputs on the guitar, all directly wired to different pickups. So the whole inside of the telly had been sort of swimming pool rooted, and then had several pickups fit. And the idea that the studio has was you could lay down a single guitar part and have it recorded, you know, four different ways through four different pickup types, just right, with one single take, in order to, you know, prevent constant, you know, more and more takes and stuff. So yeah, it was a really weird idea, and kind of such a Frankenstein of a guitar even before Springsteen got it. So even before it became like one of the most gig guitars of all time, it had already had such a hard life and had been through, you know, so many different iterations.
And so there's a really good article on it on Rolling Stone about it. And yeah, Joe, you're completely right again, that the guitar had four pickups wired into extra jacks. So what this article says is there was four pickups wired into extra jacks that would each plug into a separate channel on the recording console, so that the session player could collect four times union scale for playing four slightly different versions of the same guitar solo. So I guess it meant that they were getting paid four times for playing once.
Sure.
So that's pretty funny. That's I mean, that is like, if I've understood that correctly, that is the most Bruce Springsteen thing I could ever imagine. Basically just like, you know, yeah, this guitar's for the working man. Like, you know, I'm getting paid four times for playing one solo.
That's amazing. Yeah. Absolutely amazing. I don't think you get away with that these days.
Yeah, but The shop that he bought it from, Patillo's store in New Jersey, is still there, and he does still do that. He'll do a refretting with his precision frets for anyone who takes their guitar in as well, which is really interesting.
That's amazing.
Patillo died in 2010, so he's not doing it, but maybe they are continuing on the tradition.
Sure. Yeah, I guess so.
Ghost frets. That's the real meaning of ghost fret.
Yeah, there we go.
Joe Branson, do you want to stay on the line?
Sure.
Yeah, why? Jay, what else is on that list that we've not already talked about?
So other things that are in the list are Bonnie Raitt's 65 Strat. Okay. So Brownie is the name of that guitar. And I've never got on with naming guitars. All of these guitars have got names, but then I guess, you know, I've never owned a guitar for more than sort of 5 years or so.
Did Springsteen have a name for his? No, I don't think so.
Bonnie Raitt's Strat is a 65 that she bought in 1969. And again, I could only get a show list from setlist.fm, who definitely are not sponsoring this podcast, by the way. I think it's a very useful resource. And they have got 1,000 or so gigs listed between 1969 and 2019. And yeah, apparently she still uses the same one. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of other people, like famous guitar players that have done a lot of gigs. And I was thinking like, oh, maybe Chuck Berry, but I'm just looking at some photos now and he's used loads and loads of different hollow bodies.
Okay.
Whether they be, you know, like there's quite a lot of pictures with him with kind of modern ones. He also used a ES350T, which is the one I think that's just been reissued. But yeah, he's got like, you know, it looks like he's kind of played some like 70s ones as well. So probably not him. How about... B.B. King with the Lucille. Was there one Lucille?
No, there were loads and loads of Lucilles. There are thousands of Lucilles. It's not one guitar. He just plays loads of the same made by Gibson.
I mean, the thing about the Lucille is, and I'm sure I've got this right, is basically his house was burning down. He woke up in the middle of the night and his house was burning down or something like that. And he left his guitar to burn because he went to get his wife or save someone in the house. And that person was called Lucille. So the next time he bought a guitar, he bought the same guitar that he'd had before, like, you know, a 335 or a 355 or whatever it was. And he called it Lucille because he had like saved Lucille rather than saving his guitar. Am I making that up?
No, the story is something like that. I couldn't tell you if that you got that exactly on. Hang on. Well, let's have a look at the Wikipedia. Oh no, it wasn't his house. It was a dance hall in Arkansas. The hall was heated by a barrel half filled with.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
burning kerosene set in the middle of the dance floor, a fairly common
practice
at the time. During a performance, two men began to fight, knocking over the barrel and sending the burning fuel across the floor. The hall burst into flames and was evacuated. Once outside, however, King realized that he'd left his guitar inside, so he went back into the burning building to retrieve his beloved $30 Gibson guitar. King learned the next day that two men who started the fire had been fighting over a woman who worked at the hall named Lucille. King did not know Lucille, but named the guitar after every guitar he subsequently owned Lucille as a reminder never again to do something as so stupid as to run into a burning building or fight over a woman. There we go.
That's cool.
That's the story.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, well, you know, actually, I think my version of that was a bit more romantic, so I might continue remembering my version.
Really interestingly, Gibson have been doing a signature model of that, BB King Lucille model, since 1980.
Really?
Yeah, which seems like a long time ago.
Yeah,
what
signature models do Gibson have in their sort of standard?
Well, the thing with Gibson is that they've all pretty much always done signature models.
Joe, can I introduce you to a guitar called the Les Paul?
But even before that, you know, there's things like the Trini Lopez and stuff like that, which are
thing that I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Gibson have always had signature models in the line. But I think if I'm not mistaken, 1980 is well before any of the Fender signature models. You know, the Clapton and the Malmsteen, I think, didn't come out till, I want to say, like mid to late 80s. I can't remember the exact year now.
I think you're right. In fact, I think we did a podcast on it not too long ago. Didn't the Clapton, the Malmsteen, and the SRV come out in the same year?
Definitely the Clapton and the Malmsteen did. They came out in 1988.
Okay. Wow, 88. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. So that's pretty impressive. 1980 for the Lucille.
When was the Trini Lopez? I feel like that was pretty early. I had it in my head that maybe, you know, obviously other than the Les Paul was one of the first. I mean, Trini Lopez
1967.
That's when that guitar was released.
I believe so. Yeah, let me just... Oh,
that is very early in terms of kind of signature guitars then.
Well, again, you say that, but I think, you know, let's have a look. If you're listening to this, you're listening to men Googling, but this is kind of
you know, it's basically the gear slum, isn't it, at that point?
Well, yeah, sure. Let's have a look. Earliest signature guitars...
Whilst you're looking up that, I will just
Go back to your list.
I'll go back to my list. So another guitar that was mentioned as to guitars that maybe have done more gigs than Francis Rossi's Telly it was Keith Richards' Telly.
I was about to ask about Richards, that, whether or not that would be the next one, the Micawber, whether or not you'd discuss that yet.
Yes. So Joe, you probably missed us talking about the benchmark was very much set with Francis Rossi's Telly because. Sure. I reckon that he's played 3,500 gigs with that guitar.
Right.
So getting close to that is quite difficult. But Keith Richards got the guitar in 1971, and it was a gift.
Yeah.
The article that I saw said 1971, but that's fine. Yeah, early 70s. And it was a gift from Eric Clapton. Who appears to have given loads of people loads of guitars. So
it was for Keith Richards' 27th birthday, and it was just when the Rolling Stones were recording Exile on Main Street, which is the album that they made after they left the UK for tax reasons. They moved to France, and they very much felt like they've been forced out of the UK. And Exile on Main Street for me was my favorite Rolling Stones record, because it was it was a point for them where they weren't trying to make anything necessarily poppy, and it was the album was obviously very sort of drug and booze fueled, and it was recorded in Mick Jagger's house in France, where they just flew sort of musicians in and out, and that was the first time that Richards would have used Micawber. But of course, at that point in time when he recorded it, he hadn't even fit the PAF humbucker. He used that in its original state just as a Telecaster, and of course, you know, probably with six strings on it as well, because he didn't really develop that Open A tuning until after Exile on Main Street.
Really? I didn't realize it was like a more recent thing. I just assumed he'd sort of always been doing that.
Yeah, yeah. But there are even early videos and photos of him playing Micawber before it had had any of its customization. So he also kind of gigged it a little bit before he started messing around with it.
Going back to the signature models, earliest signature models, just this is taken from guitar.com and they're a really good article. You should check out the history of signature guitars. They seem to think that the first thing that you'd kind of describe as a signature model was a 1913 Martin for a guy called Varda Olcott Bickford, who was a Hollywood-based guitar teacher. And basically with the idea being that when someone went to him and said, what should I buy? He had an endorsed guitar made by Martin. The first Gibson seems to be the Nick Lucas flat top model, 1927, which I believe they now still do a model, like a version of. Pretty sure there's a Gibson Nick Lucas still available. I will just confirm that, but I think there is.
I tell you what, it's really funny that so that Martin came out in the 30s. I mean, they've been a company for 100 years. They've been making guitars for 100 years before someone came up with the idea of sticking someone else's name on it as a way to do some marketing. You know, I mean, that's really, really bonkers to think about.
So the Nick Lucas is not a current model, but there has been one in the last few years.
What is it? Sorry, it's just a...
It's just like a small-bodied acoustic. It's kind of like...
A parlor or something.
It's not quite a parlor, but it's like a small shape. Yeah, couldn't tell you. But it's cool. Great-looking guitar, like really nice inlays. And it's got that, you know, they do the Firestripe pickguard, which is the kind of like thick, almost looks like kind of tortoiseshell, but it's not. It's that kind of striped effect.
Okay. Love it.
Yeah, really good. And what else is on your list, going back to the topic?
Well, yeah, so just finishing off on Keith Richards, they reckon that this guitar probably, he's been playing it since 71. I think he's still playing it. I mean, in between 71 or 72, whenever it was, and 2019, that Rolling Stones, again, according to Setlist FM, played 1,100 shows, which actually doesn't sound as many as I would have thought they would have played. But then again, I guess when you get to being the size of the Rolling Stones, there really aren't that many venues you can play in the world because you're just too popular. I mean, you know, you're not going to go on a tour of the UK, are you? You'll probably play one or two shows a year.
Really. That's what it'd be really interesting to get an accurate figure on Dave Peacock, because, you know, they were probably still doing, you know, 5 or 6 gigs a week, even a few years ago, you know, a couple of years ago.
Definitely.
Whereas, like you say, the Stones would have slowed down significantly in the amount of gigs they were doing.
I mean, without wanting to make this a Chaz and Dave podcast, absolutely wanted to make this Chaz and Dave Nerds. In the time in between Chaz and Dave breaking up and then starting the band again, Chaz was still off gigging, playing Chaz and Dave songs. He played a Fender Christmas party at one point. You could just give him a bell and just be like, oh, do you want to come and play, mate? And he'd be like, yeah, of course, mate. Of course, son. I'll be there. You know, like,
I remember in a time when Chaz and Dave kind of weren't cool in the way that they are now. Whereas, you know, now there's people like in their 30s, like us, getting back into it and going, oh, this music's actually really good. But I remember when I was maybe 18, they played at like the local pub in my parents' village, and it was like maybe a tenner to get in, and I don't think it was sold out. You could just sort of potter up there and pay a tenner and go and watch them.
It's crazy.
And he would have been using that bass, and you just think that's it. A lot of gigs.
That's it. That's the thing. So, but yeah, that's sort of my list is as sort of evaporated. That's the end. I can't think of anyone else. So in terms of other bands and other people who maybe had done similar sort of numbers of gigs, Brian May and his Red Special was mentioned a number of times, but as far as I can tell, he retired the guitar, like full-time retired it, I think in like the early 90s. Wow. And has been using various copies of it. But, and again, I think this is down to the fact that he couldn't get it insured because nobody wanted to touch it because it was too valuable. Because obviously,
what do you reckon that guitar would go for at an auction now?
Who knows? You know, that guitar that he made. So everyone knows a story about it, but I'll just say it anyway. Him and his dad made the guitar in the 60s when he was a teenager. It was made out of a fireplace, so it weighs an absolute ton. It's oak, isn't it? It's oak. I'm sure it is oak. Yeah, and it weighs an absolute ton. And it's been played on basically every major Queen song of the last 50 years or so. How much is it worth? I've got no idea. I've got no idea how you put a value on that sort of thing. I mean, £1 million?
Well, I'm not even sure about that because it's like, you know, it's, I guess guitars have gone for more than that. You know, we saw the stuff at the Dave Gilmour auction and, you know, we've had the kind of Gary Moore, Peter Green, Les Paul. Yeah. But this... there is literally only one of these, you know, in terms of the guitar. I mean, there's loads of other like really good, you know, 58, 59, 60 Les Pauls. And there's loads of really other good Strats. But like, this is the one. And it was made by the guy that made the guitar famous. Like, I don't really know. And when you think it was played on like, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody and all of that, you know, it qualifies for the same things that, you know, similarly to the Dave Gilmour guitars. But it's got all the extra stuff about it that like Brian May actually made it. So yeah. I mean, I just don't know. I don't know. I think that could be the most expensive guitar of all time if it was sold.
So the only thing that I can, when you put it like that in terms of, you know, it being made by the person who played it, this, that and the other, I think the only thing that could probably come close is the log.
Yep. But then that doesn't have the same, for me, that doesn't have the same kind of mass appeal that something like the Brian May guitar has.
Yeah, no, of course, because it's a log, you know. Yeah. It's that, yeah. I mean, it's a log with six strings and a weird tremolo put on it, whereas the Red Special is just this, it's just so iconic. Like nothing, it really is so iconic, you know. All of the replicas that we used to sell them at GAC, and they were so popular. And actually I was doing a little bit of reading about that guitar earlier today, and apparently the first mass produced replica of the Red Special was made by Greco, and it was completely unlicensed, and in what can only be described as a move of just absolute like power play, they sent him one. They sent him one and he went, oh crikey, this is good, isn't it? And he started playing it, so he used that for a while.
I did not know that. I knew that Guild had done a version of it for a while, and there's been another couple before they got round to doing the kind of Brian May guitars that we know today. But yeah, I didn't know about the Greco. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's completely bonkers.
I thought Burns did them for a while. Did Burns not do the Red Specials for a bit?
Yeah. Well, they were, Burns, Brian May, and then they were just Brian May. But like I said, that Greco story is fantastic. Just from the chat, Blim is saying, how about Steve Harris's P-Bass or Buddy Guy's Polka Dot Strat? Jay, did those come up in your research at all?
Didn't. Speaking of Steve Harris, I'm not sure how... When did he get that that West Ham logo?
I think he plays quite a few different basses, doesn't he? I don't think he sticks to just the one. He's obviously got that West Ham one, but he had his he was playing just a plain white one for a while. He also got Entwistle gave him one of the it's a normal P bass, but it's like a 51 cut, so it's no contours. He had one of those for a bit as well. So I think he's moved, you know, between a few different bases.
Yeah, I don't really know enough about it, because just looking at just a quick Google image search, he does seem to just play two bases, and they are, I mean, either they're the base that his signature models have been based on, or they're his signature models. It looks like the blue sparkly one Is the one that he was playing back in the day with the mirror plate on it.
When you say back in the day, how early are you talking?
Well, I'm looking at pictures that are clearly from, like, you know, the first few albums that it's looking like.
Wow, okay.
You know, they're playing like pretty grotty venues by the looks of things. So I think he's played the blue sparkle one for a while. But yeah, now any recent picture, he seems to be playing the signature model, which is that top bound P bass with the West Ham logo. But I mean, there's others. There's one here where he's playing like a red P bass. So I think, yeah, they've obviously done a lot of gigs, but I don't think he's stuck with one bass long enough to beat any of the other ones that we've talked about.
In terms of, while we're talking about bass players, one that I did think about, and I have not been able to find any information on how many gigs he played, is Herbie Flowers.
Yeah.
So Herbie Flowers has what is assumed to be the first ever jazz bass. He's got, it's a 1960, obviously. And
59, like, if it was the first.
59 jazz bass, yeah. Which he bought in 1960, I think. Can't remember the history. I'm just looking at it. I can't remember. But like, he reckons it's the first one, or maybe I've read that somewhere else. I can't remember.
Possibly.
But I'm sure.
One of the first jazz basses that kicked around was owned by Dave Gilmour. He had a 59 Stackpot Concentric Sunburst, very lovely jazz bass, which Guy Pratt, Pink Floyd bassist, had been trying to buy off of him ever since he joined the band, and Guy Pratt ended up marrying Dave Gilmour's daughter, and on their wedding day, when they got back to the house, Dave Gilmour had left the bass at his front door.
Just outside.
Well, I don't know the details, but that's he'd been trying to buy it off of him for years, and Dave Gilmour was always like, no, it's, you can't, because it's, you know, it's a prototype, it's one of the first, it's very important.
Blim has raised a good point in the chat. Sting with his P bass. I've just done a quick Google image search, and it does seem that apart from a couple of instances where he's playing a Spectre, when he's playing a four-string bass, he's usually playing that the really old school P bass that he's got. There's a couple
51,
of
it's a 51, isn't
51,
it?
51, yeah. There's a couple of pictures where he's playing a kind of regular P bass, but not many. So that might.
I think it's a 51.
I thought it was a 51. Oh no, 57.
It's got contours, 57. So it's it's post
right.
The contours.
Oh, okay.
Not 57, yeah. Mate. 54. 57 would be when they started doing split coil pickups in it. It
so
has to be pre.
57 is when it became the real P bass. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Maybe it is. Maybe you're right. 54. Maybe I'm just seeing one labeled as a 57 here. But
yeah,
maybe
that was certainly the transition year. So maybe he got one right on the cusp. Certainly his one had the white plate, which didn't come out until post 55, and then all the contours, which, you know, then moved over onto the split call.
The reason that I bring it up, not only because I think he might be a candidate for that, but I've just seen a picture of him playing Joe Branton's absolute dream bass. Get this, right? Hamer, obviously great. Explorer body, great. 8-string, great. Fretless.
Yeah, I'm totally in. Sting's got a great taste in basses. I mean, you know, that old, you know, 50 something, it just looks better and better the more.
I think it's a 54 now that I think about it.
It's certainly, right. His is certainly, it would have to be 54, 55, because even in 54, it was still just a black guard. They moved to a white guard around 55. But yeah, it looks great. And it just seems to get more and more wrecked, you know, as he's sort of kept it, you know, he's kept playing it. It's such a cool looking bass. But you know, you're right, he has a great taste in other basses as well, like those Spectre Euros. Oh, they're absolutely fantastic looking
the
and
best,
sounding
the,
basses as well.
The best thing about his P bass is that he's been using it on the Sting and Shaggy tour this year.
Whenever I saw him doing that, he was playing an SG because he was playing guitar for that.
It looks like he's been playing bass, definitely on the Tiny Desk concert that I mentioned on the podcast a couple months ago. He was playing bass on that, but I think on the music videos and stuff, he's been playing guitar.
Very cool. Very cool.
Just
I found an image of him playing a Steinberger as well. So, you know, he's just going up and up in my estimations.
Just to jump back a minute, according to the Fender website, the first jazz bass was March 1960. So,
Fair enough. Yeah.
So I'm not sure. Maybe 59 was
certainly prototypes would have been coming out around then, I think.
Herbie Flowers, I have in my head as someone he's got like a really early 1960 jazz bass, and he still plays it. And so like for people who don't know who we're talking about, Herbie Flowers was a session musician throughout the 60s. Probably his most iconic bass line is he played bass on Take a Walk on the Wild Side, the Lou Reed song, and it's that really iconic just like bow, bow, bow. And it's just such a good bass line. It's absolutely fantastic. And I'd really like to see him play. He's another one like Chaz and Dave who just sort of goes out and just does it. You know, he played in Rottingdean, which is a little village just outside of Brighton, just earlier this year. And I really wanted to go, but I couldn't make it.
That bass might be a contender for the most gigs. So he bought it bought it in 1965, I believe, and it is a 1960.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. How would you find out how many gigs he's done? You know, that's...
I mean, I don't know if you can, you know.
I'm just going to Google Herbie Flowers amount of gigs. Well, let's see what happens. Herbivore Flowers. Herbie Flowers amount of gigs. This is someone Googling live on a podcast. I can't tell you. There's no information, unfortunately. But I reckon that could be a candidate for it. Absolutely.
Another couple of options, another couple of ideas that I've just had. And I don't know. I don't know how many gigs I would have played. But Lindsey Buckingham and his weird signature guitar. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I doubt that though, because he wasn't using that when they were doing loads of gigs.
Was.
Really?
Yeah. So that guitar is, he got it in 1979. So I guess that's post Rumours. When was that? 75? 77?
Something like that. Yeah.
That I think is, okay. Fleetwood Mac. That is 77. So, okay. So he would have done that. And another one, not someone who would have done the most gigs, but what about Carole Kaye in terms of most songs?
Yeah. Yep, definitely.
I don't know what she was using, but Carole Kaye, part of the Wrecking Crew, right?
Yes.
She was part of the Wrecking Crew with the drummer whose name has totally slipped out of my head. Hal Blaine.
Definitely not on the same guitar though, because if you look, she has used loads of different stuff. I believe she was using Ibanez SRXs towards the end of her career. So,
The only other thing that I could think to do, which is something that I did earlier this week, is have a look at on the Wikipedia page for list of best-selling artists and be like, okay, well, look, who's sold loads of records, who's been playing like loads of shows, because I think that's probably a decent way to look at look at people who've been playing a large number of gigs. And obviously right up the top there, maybe alongside Elvis, is the Beatles. And this is one for you really, Mark. What's Macca been doing all these years?
Just using a variety of stuff. He's never
won guitar.
There's a bit of a story behind the violin bass, because the original violin bass got stolen. And obviously he would have done a fair amount of gigs on the original one, and then it got stolen, I believe in the like mid-60s, something like that. So there was another one. He's obviously used Rickenbackers a lot. He's used Wow for a significant,
really?
Significant okay. portion of the kind of late 80s, early 90s, I believe. But it's so weird with him, you know, because in the studio he's like using loads of stuff, and even I think on gigs he plays a bit of guitar and he plays piano and stuff like that. So I don't think there's kind of one instrument that he would have used a lot for every gig, if that makes sense.
Okay. And then another one, whilst we're talking about your specialist subject, Bobby D. What was his deal?
Absolutely everything and anything.
No one iconic guitar or anything.
Don't think really cares about it. I mean, he does have iconic guitars, but not that have done loads of gigs.
Okay.
You know, he's used Strats, Tellys, he's used loads of different Martins. So yeah, nothing that would have done a ton of gigs. But definitely not in, you know, the recent years, because he doesn't really play guitar anymore, kind of plays piano. Guitar Bob raises a good point. Johnny Greenwood's Telly Plus, because isn't that the only guitar that he plays?
I think it is. He plays a few.
He's got he has three Telly Pluses, but you think he's alternating between that and an old Fender. What was the what's the name of the hollow body Fender? Not the Coronado.
Starcaster.
So he has a Starcaster that he plays quite a bit as well. But he's got three.
They would have been played. He probably switches between them during shows, right?
Telly Pluses, he certainly does. And of course, the original Telly Plus got nicked anyway. So he, that would have been the first sort of handful of records, at least.
Right. Okay.
To wrap this one up, because we've kind of approaching time, Blim's raised a good point in the chat saying the correct answer is going to be someone who none of us have ever heard of, who's been playing the same no-caster every night in Nashville since 1950. And I think, is absolutely the correct answer to this is we will never know. It would be someone doing session gigs or, you know, doing, covers gigs or something like that. Probably absolutely amazing, but someone who we will never, ever know their name. With that, I think it's time to wrap up this live episode. If you've joined us listening tonight, thank you very much. If you've joined in the chat, even better. You've helped us get through another hour of podcasting this week in the run-up to the Marathon Gear of the Year podcasts that we're recording next weekend and releasing next week. So, or when you hear this, if you're hearing this recorded, it will be we're recording tomorrow and Sunday, and then it'll be live on Monday. So yeah, thanks for everyone who's helped out in the chat and give us inspiration and some suggestions. Jay Cross, thanks for joining us.
It's quite all right. Just before we go, can I just bring up I know that you've just done a really good wrap-up. It was really good, but there's one other thing that's just come to mind after I watched this documentary on country music last week, and Marty Stewart, who was in Johnny Cash's band back in the day, he's a session guitar player and everything, but he spent a long time playing mandolin, and he played mandolin for Johnny Cash, and his mandolin is extremely iconic because there's a really funny story that he tells about how he had been playing this mandolin for about 15 years and he had kept it absolutely pristine. And he was so proud of this mandolin. And then one night after a gig, he found Johnny Cash with a knife carving his initials into the front of the mandolin. So Johnny, so if you see a picture of Marty Stewart's mandolin, it's got JRC etched into the front of it, and ever since then he's just gone like, well, I guess that's it now, isn't it? So he has got other people, anytime he's played with someone famous, he's got other people to etch their name into the front of his mandolin. So this is some sort of 60s model, I think. So I would say that's probably up there, but of course that's a mandolin, and mandolins are not as cool as electric guitars, and they're certainly not as cool as precision basses. So I guess that probably discounts it from this conversation anyway.
So as with every Guitar Nerds podcast, the ultimate winner is Chaz and Dave. Jay, thanks for joining us. Joe Branton, thanks for taking some time out of your evening to join us as well.
Indeed.
And the next time we speak to you all, it will be Gear of the Year. So that'll be fun. It'll be long, but it'll be fun. Thanks for joining. Bye-bye.
Peace, gang.
Farewell.
Anyone who's listening live, thanks very much for joining us in the chat. Thanks for giving us ideas and stuff. And great fun. We'll be doing some more Guitar Nerds Live next year. We're going to try and scale things up a bit with regards to like Patreon and doing more stuff for you if you've signed up for Patreon. We've got Gear of the Decade coming up, and we've got some other ideas about how we can give you even more value for money than you already get. So thanks very much, and Let's go on, Jay. You sound like you want to say something.
I was just going to... Joe, that picture of Sting, when's that from?
I don't know. It looks pretty early.
Let's look early, because the thing that I find really funny about that is...
the Fender strap.
You see that strap he's playing? That's still in the catalogue. That's one of the biggest selling products. That's been in the catalogue since about 1959. And it's still going strong. It's really funny.
That's got to be your longest unbroken product run, right?
So it might not be 50s, but it's really early. Really early. So yeah, it's really funny.
Right, thanks very much for listening, everyone. And we'll see you at Gear of the Year.
Peace and love. Farewell. Peace and love.
Bye.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds. Like the breathable, silky smooth tree dasher, the responsive foam and extra grip of the tree runner, or the classic low-top look of the tree piper. Allbirds has a lightweight, ultra-packable shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.